The next case for argument is Heller Financial. Mr. Ellis.
Good morning. May it please the court. This case is about fit and fidelity. The district court properly concluded that Section 13 of the security agreement fit the circumstances here and applied to the distribution of proceeds, but committed reversible error when it decided to prioritize among the three tranches of debt and use Section 1.5C of the credit agreement to achieve that result. The district court erred by failing to enforce, as written, the clear and unambiguous language contained in Section 13 of the security agreement, and by rewriting terms of Section 1.5C in order to...
I just have a factual question about the history of these clauses. Are these the clauses normally used in Heller's financing agreements?
Your Honor, I don't know. I can't answer that question.
One would think they are, and part of my puzzle is there no other litigation about the relation between these clauses? This can't be the first time an institution to which Heller has lent money has gone belly up.
Your Honor, I can't answer that question, but I would certainly be willing to take on the representation of Prudential if that's the case. But I can't answer that question factually.
Yeah, well, I'll obviously ask Heller's lawyer this, but it's a puzzle, at least to me.
Well, Your Honor, the only puzzle that I see here is the contention that Heller puts forth that he used a repayment provision to distribute proceeds which result from a liquidation of collateral.
If they've been doing this for 50 years, and if that's what they've been doing under these when their other debtors go bankrupt, then one understands why they did it here, but then, I'm kind of looking for traces in the history.
Again, Your Honor, I think what we're relying on is what the text is before us and the circumstances. And that is where we believe that the court erred, because by not following the clear text and unambiguous terms of Section 13 of the Security Agreement, the district court committed reversible error on that point. As this court reviews this case de novo, we urge you to consider the distinction that occurs here between a voluntary business decision to sell assets and a forced liquidation of collateral by secured lenders, because as appellants believe, this is a distinction with a significant difference. Section 1.5 nor subsection C control in this case, as they clearly deal with prepayment obligations of the borrower. Whereas on the other hand, Section 13 of the security agreement is the only provision of the applicable document which fits the circumstances of this dispute. The provisions of Section 13 are clear and unambiguous. They concern the treatment of the secured obligations of which these three tranches of debt were, following an event of default.
But of course, there's no reference to the revolving loan. Why is it that the revolving loan is supposed to be paid off first?
I think it makes perfectly good sense in the context of how the lenders view themselves when the skies are blue with this borrower. For instance, the term debt has a maturity. It's going to be paid out over time. The revolving debt is a fluctuating line of credit which ebbs and flows, goes up and down, and is contingent upon the assets behind it that support it. If a business decides to sell assets to support that line of credit, it's perfectly reasonable while that business is going on that it readjusts so the line of credit, which is being extended over time up and down, doesn't get out of line, whereas the term debt doesn't have that same concern in blue skies. In gray skies, when the company's in trouble, it matters not among the three lenders at that point, because all their risks are ready and present. All the loans, as in this case, become due and payable. The only concern in gray skies is to get as much as you possibly can.
But if the revolving loan generally is paid off first, according to 1.5C or whatever it is, then why not in bankruptcy also? I don't understand. That's just another way of what would you do in a merger, for example?
Well, again, in a merger context, Your Honor, there would be choice. There would be choice by the borrower as to engaging in that merger and working out with its lenders how it's going to be.
But it means there were no provisions. Suppose it was just an acquisition. which would be paid out first?
I think there wouldn't be a prioritization, Judge. I think the point is all the creditors, all the creditors' lines of credit, whether it be revolving or term, become due and payable upon that change of control.
I guess the problem I have is, so 1.5C discusses revolving loans specifically, and it provides for priority of repayment to the lender, the revolving loan, and this is related to Judge Easterbrook's question. Section 13 is this kind of boilerplate, which doesn't make any reference to the revolving loan. So it looks as if in 1.5C is where the parties actually thought about revolving loans.
Well, Your Honor, I think Section 13 does speak to the revolving loan as it
well,
talks about
it. Well, it doesn't mention it, and in fact, it doesn't say anything about priority. I mean, it obviously has priorities, you know, administrative and secured obligation, but it doesn't talk about priorities within a class of secured obligations.
Well, I think that point is important. It's not to say that they just forgot about it. It's because it makes sense in the context of gray skies. And when at the point in time where a company is in default and in bankruptcy, as Section 13 contemplates.
But if you were a revolving lender and you looked at 1.5C, you would say, well, you know, I get paid first.
Well, that's sort of what the district court did here, Judge. It isolated a single sentence out of 1.5C and said, that's it. I can come to a rational conclusion if I just isolate the first sentence of 1.5C and excise it from the remaining portions of that provision. And that doesn't follow. The judge needed to enforce each provision as written, and if it came to logical and sensible consequences, then of course it would apply. But
now,
that's not the case.
Neither party presented any extrinsic evidence, any negotiating history or trade usage or anything that might disambiguate these clauses. Is that correct?
Well, there's no extrinsic evidence, Your Honor, but it's the appellate position that there is nothing ambiguous about the text.
Well, you're both arguing it's unambiguous. That's always...
That's the nature of the problem. Section 13 deals with insolvency and doesn't mention revolving credit, right? Section 1.5C deals specifically with the revolving loan and doesn't deal specifically with insolvency. And so we get one of these standard cases where, in one respect, each clause is more specific than the other and applicable to this circumstance. One reason why we would like to know, almost surely no underlying negotiation here, but what is the history of these things? Heller is a repeat player in this business, so one would like to know what's happened on earlier plays.
Your Honor, I don't think we need to go into that analysis, only because Section 13 does address the secured obligations, and there's no question that the revolving loan as well as the term loans are the secured obligations that the security agreement speaks to. There's no question that that's the case. The fact that it doesn't name it as revolver and isolate it as revolver doesn't...
But, of course, they make the same argument about 1.3C, which talks about prepayment.
Well, you're right.
The revolving loan. Of course, you say it's not a prepayment. It's a kind of prepayment, isn't it? I mean, you know, there's bankruptcy, so everything becomes due.
But it's not a prepayment.
Due early, so it's prepaid.
But, Your Honor, it has matured and it has accelerated. And you cannot prepay a debt that has matured or accelerated.
Well, but one could equally say that all of 1.5C is irrelevant on that ground because you can never prepay a revolving loan.
Well, I think there...
You can only prepay a loan that has scheduled term payments, and the revolving loan doesn't.
That's correct, right? Perhaps we're hampered by the limitations of language to describe how you repay a line of credit that's been used in the context of a prepayment provision, but it doesn't change.
Yeah, but since you can never prepay a revolving loan, the concept just doesn't match revolving lines of credit. Right? There's obviously something wrong in the caption. It makes it rather hard to rely on the caption.
Your Honor, we don't need to rely on the caption to figure out what Section 1.5 involves. If you look at every provision of Section 1.5, it deals with the relationship between the borrower and the lenders on an ongoing basis. 1.5A deals with prepayments that result from the... It deals with the prepayments from when you pay in advance and there are breakage fees for breaking the terms of the continuing debt on the term loan. Section 1.5 deals with prepayments from excess cash flow. Section 1.5B deals with prepayments from the issuance of securities. So we don't need the headings. We just need to look at what the paragraphs say within Section 1.5 to see that it is intended to deal with an ongoing business, a going concern. That concern's obligations to make payments or prepayments to its secured lenders. And when we pointed these facts out to the district court, Heller and Key, as well as the district court, tinkered with the express language of Section 1.5C to make it fit the circumstances here. Heller changed the words prepay the term loans to pay off the term loans. Key changed the same phrase to apply against the term loans and apply to the term loans. The district court used the
word...
That's
the only possible sense that prepay can have, since you agree that it is impossible ever to prepay a revolving line of credit.
As the revolving line, right? But it doesn't just say that. Yeah. It says that with respect to the term loans. You can prepay the term loans. And by changing the language to pay against or pay off, they're trying to change the circumstances to make them fit here because the possibilities are exposed once you apply each and every sentence of Section 1.5C to the distribution of proceeds following the sale of collateral. And it's our position that was error, Your Honor, and that we request that this court reverse this decision back to the district court with an entry of an order with a pro rata distribution of the net proceeds.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Allen. Mr. LaGuori?
Good morning. May it please the court. Let me first address Judge Easterbrook's question about the use of these types of clauses and other agreements by Heller. While that is certainly not of the record in this case, it's my understanding that while Heller begins with a standard clause, those clauses are altered depending on the particular circumstance of the transaction. And so one cannot say that this particular clause that is at issue in this litigation is at issue in other cases.
Well, but do you know whether it is?
All I know is that each clause that Heller uses in its agreement is modified to fit the particular circumstance. And as far as I know, there has been no litigation of this nature in any court. So with respect to your second question, Judge Easterbrook, about the history of any litigation involving these types of clauses, at least as Heller is concerned, I am unaware of any such litigation. Now,
I have another question about the history of litigation, not of other litigations, but why are we here? That is, this is a distribution in bankruptcy. How is it that a distribution in bankruptcy is being handled by anybody other than the bankruptcy court?
It wasn't a distribution in bankruptcy, Your Honor. The sale was approved by the bankruptcy court, but once the sale was approved, the money was paid out to Heller as agent, and it's my understanding that the bankruptcy court no longer had jurisdiction over this issue. And so Heller
certainly had jurisdiction. All three of the parties here are creditors of the bankrupt.
Correct.
Heller may be acting for them in some respects and not others, but all three of them are creditors. It's a standard function of bankruptcy to divvy up the proceeds among the creditors. And it looks to me like what's going on here is the bankruptcy court is just trying to shuck its work. And it didn't pan out very well, it seems.
Well, I would not want to impugn the reputation of the bankruptcy court whatsoever. I don't believe that the bankruptcy court here is shucking its work. I believe that after the assets were distributed...
I will say you're just very lucky that things worked out, because the device you used to come back into court, interpleader, is completely inappropriate. Heller didn't tender all the money and leave the other two parties to fight it out. Heller is the major claimant to the money. Right, so this is not a situation in which you could avoid the normal requirement of diversity of citizenship. Now, it happens, we've checked, there is complete diversity of citizenship rather than the interpleader minimal diversity. But if the idea was that you just come back into federal court under minimal diversity and avoid the normal requirements of federal litigation, having also avoided the bankruptcy, that's... Well, as I say, you lucked out here.
Well, we were aware, certainly, that there was complete diversity of citizenship. And in initiating the interpleader action, Heller did not take a position as to the distribution of the assets. It filed a two-count interpleader claim. The first count was, to seek relief for the discharge of its duties as agent, and the second issue, or the second count, was to seek a finding of good faith. Only when Prudential filed its motion for summary judgment, well, the court encouraged cross motions for summary judgment, did Heller, as a stakeholder, take a position in the litigation with respect to the distribution of funds. Now,
do you have a comment, a question I asked Mr. Ellis, which is what the purpose is of having a revolving lender paid first?
I actually
apart from the bankruptcy or a merger or anything like that, in the ordinary course.
I agree with Mr. Ellis on that front. The amended and restated credit agreement was structured such that when assets that backed up the revolving loan continuing obligation to extend credit to APG were disposed of, the agreement provided that because that collateral was being disposed of, the revolving loan had to have a corresponding reduction. In other words, APG had to pay back.
Because it would be undersecured otherwise?
Exactly. It would be undersecured. And so therefore, the agreement provided that upon that particular circumstance, the revolving loan needed to be repaid. Now, Judge Posner, the opposite is also true, of course. If there were fixed assets that were being sold, then only fixed assets, in other words, assets that did not collateralize the revolving loan, then, of course, this agreement doesn't provide that the revolving loan has to be paid back. It's because in this particular transaction, the receivables and the inventory, in other words, the assets that were collateralizing the revolving loan, were part of the sale. That is the reason why it was required that the revolving loan be paid back first pursuant to 1.5C. And of course, all the lenders knew what the priorities were in the loan agreement when they entered into these, when they agreed to be lenders to the debtor. Now, you asked the question of the appellant as to what are the reasons why the revolving loan would not be given preference in the event of a bankruptcy. And the answer to that is there is no reason. And in fact, the credit agreement doesn't provide a reason. Section 1.5C's application with respect to the repayment of the revolving loan is unconditional. It's not contingent upon a condition precedent or a condition subsequent. It requires when inventory and
pause a minute. Can you give me an example of a condition subsequent?
For example, I suppose if the agreement provided that before the revolving loan had to be repaid, the debtor had to do...
No, that's a condition precedent. As soon as you say before.
I can't think of one as I stand here, Your Honor.
Neither could I.
But nevertheless, there are no conditions attached to the application of the repayment obligation contained in 1.5C. And so for that reason, Your Honor, there is no reason why in the event of a bankruptcy that would destroy the preference given to the revolving loan when assets of this nature are sold. And frankly, Section 13, the section of the security agreement that the appellants rely on, is not inconsistent with that. While, as the district court found, that sets forth a hierarchy of payments between different classes of debt, but it does not provide how proceeds are to be distributed between the same classes of debt. It is silent. What the district court found was that Section 13 and Section 1.5C can be read together, that even though you have a hierarchical structure with respect to different classes of debt, when you got within a particular class, 1.5C provided you with guidance as to how proceeds should be distributed among the same classes of debt, the classes of debt that are at issue here. Now, in their opening brief, Prudential took the position that the two provisions conflict because Section 13, on the one hand, provides for a pro rata distribution, whereas Section 1.5C provides for a hierarchical distribution. And it said that because Section 13 was the more specific of the two provisions, that section had to control. But of course, the credit agreement itself tells us that Prudential is wrong on that score. What the amended and restated credit agreement provide in two parts, not one but two parts, in sections 1.1F and section 9.2, that to the extent there is any conflict between these two provisions, the amended and restated credit agreement controls. The district court obviously didn't have to wrestle with that issue because it found that the two clauses did not conflict. But here, of course, if the court is wrestling with that, then there is an easy answer, which is that Section 1.5 or Section 13 has to yield to Section 1.5C because it is to be given preference. Now, Prudential makes a number of other arguments as to why Section 1.5C doesn't apply. It argues that based on its placement, it doesn't apply. And of course, the amended and restated credit agreement says exactly the opposite. In the district court, Prudential argued that it was the subsection heading that indicated that this applied only to transactions that have occurred while the debtor is an ongoing concern. The district court rejected that argument for, among other reasons, because the credit agreement in Section 9.8 specifically provides that the subsection headings are to be given no substantive meaning.
Could you say something about the borrowing base issue? I found that confusing, borrowing base being reduced to zero. What is that?
Sure. Prudential makes the argument that upon entry of the final DIP order, the borrowing base was reduced to zero. And as a result of that, according to Prudential, if Section 1.5C were to apply, the district court erred in its order of distribution because the borrowing base was not reduced by virtue of the sale. And Section 1.5C says that you have to pay back the revolving loan to the extent the borrowing base has been reduced. Now, that argument is wrong for several reasons, which I believe we've articulated in our brief. The final DIP order was agreed to by all the parties, and in that DIP order, the parties made available to the debtor two alternative sources of financing, cash collateral and DIP financing as a backstop to the cash collateral. In the agreement, the creditors, which all the creditors agreed to the DIP order, the creditors specifically preserved the borrowing base as a benchmark to measure the ability of the debtor to use cash collateral and DIP financing. The borrowing base concept with respect to cash collateral is in Section 5. The borrowing base as a yardstick for the use of DIP financing is in the post-petition financing agreement, which is attached to the final DIP.
Well,
order.
Could you be more concrete? What is the purpose?
The purpose of the preservation of the
borrowing base.
The borrowing base is again to limit the risk of the post-petition lender and the revolving lenders with respect to the extension of cash collateral to the debtor post-petition. And the reason for that is, just like the borrowing base was used as the benchmark for the extension of credit under the revolving loan, the borrowing base post-petition was used as the benchmark to limit the debtor's access to cash post-petition. And as a result of that, obviously, if the borrowing base had been reduced to zero, then this debtor, who the lenders were all trying to get through to a sale, keep it ongoing, through to a sale to maximize its value, the debtor would have been unable to tap either the cash collateral that was being made available to it or the DIP financing, because according to Prudential, the borrowing base had reverted to zero, and based on the formulas in the final DIP order, the debtor would have been prohibited from accessing or tapping any of that cash. Which
the cash collateral is what? Is it the receipts of the paper company?
It is the
sales gets cash. And
exactly. Just like the revolving loan work,
right.
The use of cash collateral post-petition was the same. And in fact, the budget that is attached to the final DIP order projects that the borrowing base is not zero. It projects that the borrowing base is going to be between $5.9 and about $6.1 million. So the notion that the borrowing base was destroyed by the entry of the final DIP order, to me, is illogical, and would make the rights of the debtor to use cash meaningless. Each of the arguments posited by Prudential in favor of reversal of the district court has an Achilles heel. And the Achilles heel is that the agreements do not say what Prudential says they say. Instead, they say what the district court held, that upon this type of transaction, the revolving loan was to be given preference. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. LaGuari. Mr. Ellis, how much time does he have? 3 minutes?
Thank you, Judge. I'd like to take up these 2 points. The first being that Section 1.5C and Section 13 are in conflict in as much as Section 13 deals with an event of default and Section 1.5C does not. It doesn't mean that there isn't a rational basis not to use Section 13. It clearly applies in the context of bankruptcy, whereas Section 1.5C does not. We want to point out to you what happens to the distribution of proceeds through 1.5C, which exposes why it doesn't apply in this case. To Judge Easterbrook's point, 1.5C requires repayment, not prepayment of the revolving debt, repayment. Once you get beyond that isolated sentence, the remaining $6.8 or $6.9 million has nowhere to go through the application of Section 1.5C. There's no way that the bankrupt debtor is going to reinvest that $6.9 million. And there's no way the bankrupt debtor is going to have the ability to prepay term loans which have already matured and been accelerated. That's what's wrong with going to 1.5C, because there's nothing you can do with the $6.8 or $6.9 million after you repay the revolving debt. But let's take Heller and Key at their word. They say Section 1.5C ought to apply to the distribution of proceeds here. And let's look at what the definition of borrowing base really is. Not what effect did it have to the post-petition creditor's ability to be repaid once the business is fully liquidated, but let's look at what it really is. The definition is ineligible assets and inventory. And in this case, at the time that the final DIP order is entered, that's exactly what we had. Ineligible inventory and assets, all of them, because the secured lenders lost their priming liens. That's the definition that was carried over into the final DIP order. It refers back to the definition in the credit agreement. There's no way to escape that language. So with respect to the definition of borrowing base, it's clear when you want to apply the distribution of proceeds here that the borrowing base was reduced to zero and the revolving loan is not entitled to any repayment with the distribution of funds. And if that occurs, that inures to the larger benefit of Prudential, as it was not a participant in the revolving loan. So let's say Key at their word, Key and Heller at their word, that 1.5C applies. But you have to remain loyal to what the definition of borrowing base is. Not what it might mean for the post-petition creditor, but what it means for the pre-petition creditors who are fighting over the proceeds with respect to distribution here. Your Honors, two results can happen here. One, you can remand to find out if Section 13, in fact, does govern the distribution of proceeds, because 1.5C certainly does not. Or you can remand and enter an order that would be consistent with a pro rata distribution, or if we take Key and Heller at their word, a distribution which only goes to the term debt in this case, with no distribution to the revolving loan. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for both counsel. Okay. Next case.
No, we're rising. We're getting out of here. Switch again.
Oh.
You know, you can be locked in here.